It might be a month. You'd get the first thing that we thought you could do.
I see, said Carrie, and then, half-smiling to be agreeable, she walked out. The agent studied a moment and then said to himself, It's funny how anxious these women are to get on the stage.
Carrie found ample food for reflection in the $50 proposition. Maybe they take my money and not give me anything, she thought. She had some jewelry, a diamond ring and a pin and several other pieces. She could get $50 for those if she went to a pawnbroker. Hurstwood was home before her. He had not thought she would be so long-seeking.
Well, he said, not venturing to ask what news.
I didn't find out anything today, said Carrie, taking off her gloves. They all want money to get you a place.
How much? Asked Hurstwood.
$50.
They don't want anything, do they?
Oh, they're like everybody else. You can't tell whether they'd ever get you anything after you did pay them.
Well, I wouldn't put up 50 on that basis, said Hurstwood, as if he were deciding, money in hand.
I don't know, said Carrie. I think I'll try some of the managers.
Hurstwood heard this, dead to the horror of it. He rocked a little to and fro and chewed at his finger. It seemed all very natural in such extreme states. He would do better later on.
38. In Elfland Disporting, the Grim World Without. When Carrie renewed her search, as she did the next day, going to the casino, she found that in the opera chorus, as in other fields, employment is difficult to secure. Girls who can stand in a line and look pretty are as numerous as laborers who can swing a pick. She found there was no discrimination between one and the other of applicants, save as regards a conventional standard of prettiness and form. Their own opinion or knowledge of their ability went for nothing.
"Where shall I find Mr. Gray?" she asked of a sulky doorman at the stage entrance of the casino.
"You can't see him now. He's busy."
"Do you know when I can see him?"
"Got an appointment with him?"
"No."
"Well, you'll have to call at his office."
"Oh, dear," exclaimed Carrie. "Where is his office?"
He gave her the number. She knew there was no need of calling there now. He would not be in. Nothing remained but to employ the intermediate hours in search. The dismal story of ventures in other places is quickly told. Mr. Daly saw no one save by appointment. Carrie waited an hour in a dingy office, quite in spite of obstacles, to learn this fact of the placid, indifferent Mr. Dorney.
You will have to write and ask him to see you.
So she went away.
At the Empire Theater, she found a hive of peculiarly listless and indifferent individuals. Everything ornately upholstered, everything carefully finished, everything remarkably reserved. At the Lyceum, she entered one of those secluded under-the-stairway closets, berugged and bepaneled, which causes one to feel the greatness of all positions of authority. Here was reserve itself done into a box-office clerk, a doorman, and an assistant glorying in their fine positions.
"Ah, be very humble now, very humble indeed. Tell us what it is you require. Tell it quickly, nervously, and without a vestige of self-respect. If no trouble to us in any way, we may see what we can do." This was the atmosphere of the Lyceum, the attitude, for that matter, of every managerial office in the city. These little proprietors of businesses are lords indeed on their own ground. Carrie came away wearily, somewhat more abashed for her pains. Hurstwood heard the details of the weary and unavailing search that evening.
"I didn't get to see anyone," said Carrie. "I just walked and walked and waited around."
Hurstwood only looked at her.
"I suppose you have to have some friends before you can get in," she added disconsolately.
Hurstwood saw the difficulty of this thing, and yet it did not seem so terrible.
Carrie was tired and dispirited, but now she could rest. Viewing the world from his rocking chair, its bitterness did not seem to approach so rapidly. Tomorrow was another day. Tomorrow came, and the next, and the next. Carrie saw the manager at the casino once. "Come around," he said, "the first of next week. I may make some changes then." He was a large and corpulent individual, surfeited with good clothes and good eating, who judged women as another would horse flesh. Carrie was pretty and graceful. She might be put in, even if she did not have any experience. One of the proprietors had suggested that the chorus was a little weak on looks. The first of next week was some days off yet. The first of the month was drawing near. Carrie began to worry as she had never worried before. "Do you really look for anything when you go out?" she asked Hurstwood one morning, as a climax to some painful thoughts of her own. "Of course I do," he said pettishly, troubling only a little over the disgrace of the insinuation. "I'd take anything," she said, "for the present. It will soon be the first of the month again." She looked the picture of despair. Hurstwood quit reading his paper and changed his clothes. He would look for something, he thought. He would go and see if some brewery couldn't get him in somewhere. Yes, he would take a position as bartender if he could get it. It was the same sort of pilgrimage he had made before. One or two slight rebuffs, and the bravado disappeared. No use, he thought. I might as well go on back home. Now that his money was so low, he began to observe his clothes and feel that even his best ones were beginning to look commonplace. This was a bitter thought. Carrie came in after he did. "I went to see some of the variety managers," she said aimlessly. "You have to have an act. They don't want anybody that hasn't."
"I saw some of the brewery people today," said Hurstwood. "One man told me he'd try to make a place for me in 2 or 3 weeks."
In the face of so much distress on Carrie's part, he had to make some showing, and it was thus he did so. It was lassitude's apology to energy. Monday, Carrie went again to the casino.
"Did I tell you to come around today?" said the manager, looking her over as she stood before him.
"You said the first of the week," said Carrie, greatly abashed.
"Ever had any experience?" he asked again, almost severely.
Carrie owned to ignorance. He looked her over again as he stirred among some papers. He was secretly pleased with this pretty, disturbed-looking young woman.
"Come around to the theater tomorrow morning."
Carrie's heart bounded to her throat.
"I will," she said with difficulty.
She could see he wanted her and turned to go.
Would he really put her to work? Oh, blessed fortune, could it be?
Already the hard rumble of the city through the open windows became pleasant. A sharp voice answered her mental interrogation, driving away all immediate fears on that score.
"Be sure you're there promptly," the manager said roughly. "You'll be dropped if you're not."
Carrie hastened away. She did not quarrel now with Hurstwood's idleness. She had a place. She had a place! This sang in her ears. In her delight, she was almost anxious to tell Hurstwood, but as she walked homeward and her survey of the facts of the case became larger, she began to think of the anomaly of her finding work in several weeks and his lounging in idleness for a number of months.
"Why don't he get something?" she openly said to herself.
"If I can, he surely ought to. It wasn't very hard for me."
She forgot her youth and beauty. The handicap of age she did not, in her enthusiasm, perceive. Thus ever the voice of success. Still she could not keep her secret. She tried to be calm and indifferent, but it was a palpable sham.
"Well," he said, seeing her relieved face.
"I have a place."
"You have?" he said, breathing a better breath.
"Yes."
"What sort of a place is it?" he asked, feeling in his veins as if now he might get something good also.
"In the chorus," she answered.
"Is it the casino show you told me about?"
"Yes," she answered. "I begin rehearsing tomorrow."
There was more explanation volunteered by Carrie because she was happy. At last, Hurstwood said, "Do you know how much you'll get?"
"No, I didn't want to ask," said Carrie. "I guess they pay $12 or $14 a week."
"About that, I guess," said Hurstwood. There was a good dinner in the flat that evening, owing to the mere lifting of the terrible strain. Hurstwood went out for a shave and returned with a fair-sized sirloin steak. "Now tomorrow," he thought, "I'll look around myself," and with renewed hope he lifted his eyes from the ground. On the morrow, Carrie reported promptly and was given a place in the line. She saw a large, empty, shadowy playhouse, still redolent of the perfumes and blazonry of the night, and notable for its rich, oriental appearance. The wonder of it awed and delighted her. Blessed be its wondrous reality! How hard she would try to be worthy of it! It was above the common mass, above idleness, above want, above insignificance. People came to it in finery and carriages to see. It was ever a center of light and mirth, and here she was of it. Oh, if she could only remain, how happy would be her days! "What is your name?" said the manager, who was conducting the drill.
"Medenda," she replied, instantly mindful of the name Drouet had selected in Chicago. "Carrie Medenda."
"Well, now, Miss Medenda," he said very affably, as Carrie thought, "you go over there." Then he called to a young woman who was already of the company, "Miss Clark, you pair with Miss Medenda."
This young lady stepped forward so that Carrie saw where to go, and the rehearsal began. Carrie soon found that while this drilling had some slight resemblance to the rehearsals as conducted at Avery Hall, the attitude of the manager was much more pronounced. She had marveled at the insistence and superior airs of Mr. Millis, but the individual conducting here had the same insistence, coupled with almost brutal roughness. As the drilling proceeded, he seemed to wax exceedingly wroth over trifles and to increase his lung power in proportion. It was very evident that he had a great contempt for any assumption of dignity or innocence on the part of these young women.
"Clark," he would call, meaning, of course, Miss Clark, "why don't you catch step there?" "By fours, right." "Right, I said, right. For heaven's sake, get on to yourself. Right!" And in saying this, he would lift the last sounds into a vehement roar. "Maitland, Maitland," he called once. A nervous, comely-dressed little girl stepped out. Carrie trembled for her out of the fullness of her own sympathies and fear.
"Yes, sir," said Miss Maitland.
"Is there anything the matter with your ears?"
"No, sir."
"Do you know what column left means?"
"Yes, sir."
"Well, what are you stumbling around the right for? Want to break up the line?"
"I was just..."
"Never mind what you were just. Keep your ears open."
Carrie pitied and trembled for her turn. Yet another suffered the pain of a personal rebuke.
"Hold on a minute," cried the manager, throwing up his hands as if in despair. His demeanor was fierce. "Elvers," he shouted, "what have you got in your mouth?"
"Nothing," said Miss Elvers, while some smiled and stood nervously by.
"Well, are you talking?"
"No, sir."
"Well, keep your mouth still, then. Now, all together again."
At last, Carrie's turn came. It was because of her extreme anxiety to do all that was required that brought on the trouble. She heard someone call.
"Mason," said the voice. "Miss Mason."
She looked around to see who it could be. A girl behind shoved her a little, but she did not understand.
You, said the manager. "Can't you hear?"
"Oh," said Carrie, collapsing and blushing fiercely.
"Isn't your name Mason?" asked the manager.
"No, sir," said Carrie. "It's Medenda."
"Well, what's the matter with your feet? Can't you dance?"
"Yes, sir," said Carrie, who had long since learned this art.
Well, why don't you do it, then? Don't go shuffling along as if you were dead. I've got to have people with a life in them.
Carrie's cheek burned with a crimson heat. Her lips trembled a little.
Yes, sir, she said.
It was this constant urging, coupled with irascibility and energy, for 3 long hours. Carrie came away worn enough in body, but too excited in mind to notice it. She meant to go home and practice her evolutions as prescribed. She would not err in any way if she could help it. When she reached the flat, Hurstwood was not there. For a wonder, he was out looking for work, as she supposed. She took only a mouthful to eat, and then practiced on, sustained by visions of freedom from financial distress, the sound of glory ringing in her ears. When Hurstwood returned, he was not so elated as when he went away, and now she was obliged to drop practice and get dinner. Here was an early irritation. She would have her work and this. Was she going to act and keep house? "I'll not do it," she said, "after I get started. He can take his meals out." Each day thereafter brought its cares. She found it was not such a wonderful thing to be in the chorus, and she also learned that her salary would be $12 a week. After a few days, she had her first sight of those high and mighties, the leading ladies and gentlemen. She saw that they were privileged and deferred to. She was nothing, absolutely nothing at all. At home was Hurstwood, daily giving her cause for thought. He seemed to get nothing to do, and yet he made bold to inquire how she was getting along. The regularity with which he did this smacked of someone who was waiting to live upon her labor. Now that she had a visible means of support, this irritated her. He seemed to be depending upon her little $12.
"How are you getting along?" he would blandly inquire.
"Oh, all right," she would reply.
"Find it easy?"
"It will be all right when I get used to it."
His paper would then engross his thoughts. "I got some lard," he would add as an afterthought.
"I thought maybe you might want to make some biscuit."
The calm suggestion of the man astonished her a little, especially in the light of recent developments. Her dawning independence gave her more courage to observe, and she felt as if she wanted to say things. Still, she could not talk to him as she had to Drouet. There was something in the man's manner of which she had always stood in awe. He seemed to have some invisible strength in reserve. One day, after her first week's rehearsal, what she expected came openly to the surface.
"We'll have to be rather saving," he said, laying down some meat he had purchased. "You won't get any money for a week or so yet."
"No," said Carrie, who was stirring a pan at the stove.
"I've only got the rent and $13 more," he added.
"That's it," she said to herself. "I'm to use my money now." Instantly she remembered that she had hoped to buy a few things for herself. She needed clothes. Her hat was not nice. "What will $12 do toward keeping up this flat?" she thought. "I can't do it. Why doesn't he get something to do?" The important night of the first real performance came. She did not suggest to Hurstwood that he come and see. He did not think of going. It would only be money wasted. She had such a small part. The advertisements were already in the papers, the posters upon the billboards. The leading lady and man members were cited. Carrie was nothing. As in Chicago, she was seized with stage fright as the very first entrance of the ballet approached, but later she recovered. The apparent and painful insignificance of the part took fear away from her. She felt that she was so obscure it did not matter. Fortunately, she did not have to wear tights. A group of 12 were assigned pretty golden-hued skirts, which came only to a line about an inch above the knee. Carrie happened to be one of the 12. In standing about the stage, marching and occasionally lifting up her voice in the general chorus, she had a chance to observe the audience and to see the inauguration of a great hit. There was plenty of applause, but she could not help noting how poorly some of the women of alleged ability did. "I could do better than that," Carrie ventured to herself in several instances. To do her justice, she was right. After it was over, she dressed quickly, and as the manager had scolded some others and passed her, she imagined she must have proved satisfactory. She wanted to get out quickly because she knew but few, and the stars were gossiping. Outside were carriages and some correct youths in attractive clothing waiting. Carrie saw that she was scanned closely. The flutter of an eyelash would have brought her a companion. That she did not give. One experienced youth volunteered anyhow.
"Not going home alone, are you?" he said.
Carrie merely hastened her steps and took the Sixth Avenue car. Her head was so full of the wonder of it that she had time for nothing else.
"Did you hear any more from the brewery?" she asked at the end of the week, hoping by the question to stir him on to action.
"No," he answered. "They're not quite ready yet. I think something will come of that, though."
She said nothing more then, objecting to giving up her own money and yet feeling that such would have to be the case. Hurstwood felt the crisis and artfully decided to appeal to Carrie. He had long since realized how good-natured she was, how much she would stand. There was some little shame in him at the thought of doing so, but he justified himself with the thought that he really would get something. Rent day gave him his opportunity.
"Well," he said as he counted it out, "that's about the last of my money. I'll have to get something pretty soon."
Carrie looked at him askance, half suspicious of an appeal.
"If I could only hold out a little longer, I think I could get something. Drake is sure to open a hotel here in September."
"Is he?" said Carrie, thinking of the short month that still remained until that time.
"Would you mind helping me out until then?" he said appealingly. "I think I'll be all right after that time."
"No," said Carrie, feeling sadly handicapped by fate.
"We can get along if we economize. I'll pay you back all right."
"Oh, I'll help you," said Carrie, feeling quite hard-hearted at thus forcing him to humbly appeal, and yet her desire for the benefit of her earnings wrung a faint protest from her.
"Why don't you take anything, George, temporarily?" she said. "What difference does it make? Maybe after a while you'll get something better."
"I will take anything," he said, relieved and wincing under reproof. "I'd just as leave dig on the streets. Nobody knows me here."
"Oh, you needn't do that," said Carrie, hurt by the pity of it. "But there must be other things."
"I'll get something," he said, assuming determination. Then he went back to his paper. 39. Of Lights and of Shadows. The Parting of Worlds. What Hurstwood got as a result of this determination was more self-assurance that each particular day was not the day. At the same time, Carrie passed through 30 days of mental distress. Her need for clothes, to say nothing of her desire for ornaments, grew rapidly as the fact developed that for all her work she was not to have them. The sympathy she felt for Hurstwood at the time he asked her to tide him over vanished with these newer urgings of decency. He was not always renewing his request, but this love of good appearance was. It insisted, and Carrie wished to satisfy it, wished more and more that Hurstwood was not in the way. Hurstwood reasoned, when he neared the last $10, that he had better keep a little pocket change and not become wholly dependent for car fare, shaves, and the like. So when this sum was still in his hand, he announced himself as penniless.
"I'm clear out," he said to Carrie one afternoon. "I paid for some coal this morning, and that took all but 10 or 15 cents.
I've got some money there in my purse." Hurstwood went to get it, starting for a can of tomatoes. Carrie scarcely noticed that this was the beginning of the new order.
He took out 15 cents and bought the can with it. Thereafter it was dribs and drabs of this sort, until one morning Carrie suddenly remembered that she would not be back until close to dinner time. "We're all out of flour," she said. "You'd better get some this afternoon. We haven't any meat either. How would it do if we had liver and bacon?"
"Suits me," said Hurstwood.
"Better get a half or three-quarters of a pound of that."
"Half'll be enough," volunteered Hurstwood.
She opened her purse and laid down a half-dollar. He pretended not to notice it. Hurstwood bought the flour, which all grocers sold in 3.5-pound packages, for 13 cents, and paid 15 cents for a half-pound of liver and bacon. He left the packages, together with a balance of 22 cents, upon the kitchen table, where Carrie found it. It did not escape her that the change was accurate. There was something sad in realizing that, after all he wanted of her was something to eat. She felt as if hard thoughts were unjust. Maybe he would get something yet. He had no vices. That very evening, however, on going into the theater, one of the chorus girls passed her, all newly arrayed in a pretty mottled tweed suit which took Carrie's eye. The young woman wore a fine bunch of violets and seemed in high spirits. She smiled at Carrie good-naturedly as she passed, showing pretty even teeth, and Carrie smiled back. "She can afford to dress well," thought Carrie, "and so could I if I could only keep my money. I haven't a decent tie of any kind to wear." She put out her foot and looked at her shoe reflectively. "I'll get a pair of shoes Saturday anyhow. I don't care what happens." One of the sweetest and most sympathetic little chorus girls in the company made friends with her because in Carrie she found nothing to frighten her away. She was a gay little Manon, unwitting of society's fierce conception of morality, but nevertheless good to her neighbor and charitable. Little license was allowed the chorus in the matter of conversation, but nevertheless some was indulged in. "It's warm tonight, isn't it?" said this girl, arrayed in pink fleshings and an imitation golden helmet. She also carried a shining shield. "Yes, it is," said Carrie, pleased that someone should talk to her. "I'm almost roasting," said the girl. Carrie looked into her pretty face with its large blue eyes and saw little beads of moisture. "There's more marching in this opera than I ever did before," added the girl. "Have you been in others?" asked Carrie, surprised at her experience. "Lots of them," said the girl. "Haven't you?"
"This is my first experience."
"Oh, is it? I thought I saw you the time they ran the Queen's Mate here."
"No," said Carrie, shaking her head. "Not me." This conversation was interrupted by the blare of the orchestra and the sputtering of the calcium lights in the wings as the line was called to form for a new entrance. No further opportunity for conversation occurred, but the next evening, when they were getting ready for the stage, this girl appeared anew at her side.
"They say this show is going on the road next month."
"Is it?" said Carrie.
"Yes. Do you think you'll go?"
"I don't know. I guess so, if they'll take me."
"Oh, they'll take you. I wouldn't go. They won't give you any more, and it will cost you everything you make to live. I never leave New York. There are too many shows going on here."
"Can you always get into another show?"
"I always have. There's one going up at the Broadway this month. I'm going to try and get in that if this one really goes."
Carrie heard this with aroused intelligence. Evidently, it wasn't so very difficult to get on. Maybe she could also get a place if this show went away.
"Do they all pay about the same?" she asked. "Yes, sometimes you get a little more. This show doesn't pay very much."
"I get 12, said Carrie.
"Do you?" said the girl. "They pay me 15, and you do more work than I do. I wouldn't stand it if I were you. They're just giving you less because they think you don't know. You ought to be making 15.
"Well, I'm not," said Carrie.
"Well, you'll get more at the next place if you want it," went on the girl, who admired Carrie very much. "You do fine, and the manager knows it." To say the truth, Carrie did unconsciously move about with an air pleasing and somewhat distinctive. It was due wholly to her natural manner and total lack of self-consciousness. "Do you suppose I could get more up at the Broadway?"
"Of course you can," answered the girl. "You come with me when I go. I'll do the talking."
Carrie heard this, flushing with thankfulness. She liked this little gaslight soldier. She seemed so experienced and self-reliant in her tinsel helmet and military accoutrements. "My future must be assured if I can always get work this way," thought Carrie. Still, in the morning, when her household duties would infringe upon her, and Hurstwood sat there, a perfect load to contemplate, her fate seemed dismal and unrelieved. It did not take so very much to feed them under Hurstwood's close-measured buying, and there would possibly be enough for rent, but it left nothing else. Carrie bought the shoes and some other things which complicated the rent problem very seriously. Suddenly, a week from the fatal day, Carrie realized that they were going to run short.
"I don't believe," she exclaimed, looking into her purse at breakfast, "that I'll have enough to pay the rent."
"How much have you?" inquired Hurstwood.
"Well, I've got $22, but there's everything to be paid for this week yet. And if I use all I get Saturday to pay this, there won't be any left for next week." "Do you think your hotel man will open his hotel this month?"
"I think so," returned Hurstwood. "He said he would." After a while, Hurstwood said, "Don't worry about it. Maybe the grocer will wait. He can do that. We've traded here long enough to make him trust us for a week or two."
"Do you think he will?" she asked.
"I think so." On this account, Hurstwood, this very day, looked grocer Erslaga clearly in the eye as he ordered a pound of coffee and said, "Do you mind carrying my account until the end of every week?"
"No, no, Mr. Wheeler," said Mr. Erslaga. "That is all right."
Hurstwood, still tactful in distress, added nothing to this. It seemed an easy thing. He looked out of the door and then gathered up his coffee when ready and came away. The game of a desperate man had begun. Rent was paid, and now came the grocer. Hurstwood managed by paying out of his own 10 and collecting from Carrie at the end of the week. Then he delayed a day next time settling with the grocer, and so soon had his 10 back, with Erslaga getting his pay on this Thursday or Friday for last Saturday's bill. This entanglement made Carrie anxious for a change of some sort. Hurstwood did not seem to realize that she had a right to anything. He schemed to make what she earned cover all expenses, but seemed not to trouble over adding anything himself. "He talks about worrying," thought Carrie. "If he worried enough, he wouldn't sit there and wait for me. He'd get something to do. No man could go 7 months without finding something if he tried." The sight of him always around in his untidy clothes and gloomy appearance drove Carrie to seek relief in other places. Twice a week there were matinees, and then Hurstwood ate a cold snack, which he prepared himself. 2 other days there were rehearsals beginning at 10 in the morning and lasting usually until 1. Now, to this, Carrie added a few visits to 1 or 2 chorus girls, including the blue-eyed soldier of the golden helmet. She did it because it was pleasant and a relief from dullness of the home over which her husband brooded. The blue-eyed soldier's name was Osborne, Lola Osborne. Her room was in 19th Street, near 4th Avenue, a block now given up wholly to office buildings. Here she had a comfortable back room, looking over a collection of backyards in which grew a number of shade trees pleasant to see.
"Isn't your home in New York?" she asked of Lola one day. "Yes, but I can't get along with my people. They always want me to do what they want. Do you live here?"
"Yes," said Carrie.
"With your family?"
Carrie was ashamed to say that she was married. She had talked so much about getting more salary and confessed to so much anxiety about her future that now, when the direct question of fact was waiting, she could not tell this girl. "With some relatives," she answered. Miss Osborne took it for granted that, like herself, Carrie's time was her own. She invariably asked her to stay, proposing little outings and other things of that sort, until Carrie began neglecting her dinner hours. Hurstwood noticed it, but felt in no position to quarrel with her. Several times she came so late as scarcely to have an hour in which to patch up a meal and start for the theater. "Do you rehearse in the afternoons?" Hurstwood once asked, concealing almost completely the cynical protest and regret which prompted it.
"No, I was looking around for another place," said Carrie.
As a matter of fact, she was, but only in such a way as furnished the least straw of an excuse. Miss Osborne and she had gone to the office of the manager who was to produce the new opera at the Broadway and returned straight to the former's room, where they had been since 3 o'clock. Carrie felt this question to be an infringement on her liberty. She did not take into account how much liberty she was securing. Only the latest step, the newest freedom, must not be questioned. Hurstwood saw it all clearly enough. He was shrewd after his kind, and yet there was enough decency in the man to stop him from making any effectual protest. In his almost inexplicable apathy, he was content to droop supinely while Carrie drifted out of his life, just as he was willing supinely to see opportunity pass beyond his control. He could not help clinging and protesting in a mild, irritating, and ineffectual way, however, a way that simply widened the breach by slow degrees. A further enlargement of this chasm between them came when the manager, looking between the wings upon the brightly lighted stage where the chorus was going through some of its glittering evolutions, said to the master of the ballet, "Who is that fourth girl there on the right? The one coming round at the end now?"
"Oh," said the ballet master, "that's Miss Medenda."
"She's good looking. Why don't you let her head that line?"
"I will," said the man.
"Just do that. She'll look there better than the woman you've got."
"All right, I will do that," said the master.
The next evening Carrie was called out, much as if for an error. "You lead your company tonight," said the master.
"Yes, sir," said Carrie.
"Put Snap into it," he added. "We must have Snap."
"Yes, sir," replied Carrie.
Astonished at this change, she thought that the heretofore leader must be ill, but when she saw her in the line, with a distinct expression of something unfavorable in her eye, she began to think that perhaps it was merit. She had a chic way of tossing her head to one side and holding her arms as if for action, not listlessly. In front of the line, this showed up even more effectually.
"That girl knows how to carry herself," said the manager another evening. He began to think that he should like to talk with her. If he hadn't made it a rule to have nothing to do with members of the chorus, he would have approached her most unbendingly.
"Put that girl at the head of the white column," he suggested to the man in charge of the ballet. This white column consisted of some 20 girls, all in snow-white flannel trimmed with silver and blue. Its leader was most stunningly arrayed in the same colors, elaborated, however, with epaulettes and a belt of silver with a short sword dangling at one side. Carrie was fitted for this costume, and a few days later appeared, proud of her new laurels. She was especially gratified to find that her salary was now 18 instead of 12. Hurstwood heard nothing about this.
"I'll not give him the rest of my money," said Carrie. "I do enough. I am going to get me something to wear."
As a matter of fact, during this second month she had been buying for herself as recklessly as she dared, regardless of the consequences. There were impending more complications rent day and more extension of the credit system in the neighborhood. Now, however, she proposed to do better by herself. Her first move was to buy a shirtwaist, and in studying these she found how little her money would buy, how much if she could only use all. She forgot that if she were alone she would have to pay for a room and board, and imagined that every cent of her 18 could be spent for clothes and things that she liked. At last she picked upon something which not only used up all her surplus above 12, but invaded that sum. She knew she was going too far, but her feminine love of finery prevailed. The next day, Hurstwood said, "We owe the grocer $5.40 this week." "Do we?" said Carrie, frowning a little. She looked in her purse to leave it. "I've only got $8.20 altogether." "We owe the milkman 60 cents," added Hurstwood. "Yes, and there's the coal man," said Carrie. Hurstwood said nothing. He had seen the new thing she was buying, the way she was neglecting household duties, the readiness with which she was slipping out afternoons and staying. He felt that something was going to happen. All at once she spoke. "I don't know," she said. "I can't do it all. I don't earn enough." This was a direct challenge. Hurstwood had to take it up. He tried to be calm. "I don't want you to do it all," he said. "I only want a little help until I can get something to do." "Oh, yes," answered Carrie. "That's always the way. It takes more than I can earn to pay for things. I don't see what I'm going to do." "Well, I've tried to get something," he exclaimed. "What do you want me to do?"
"You couldn't have tried so very hard," said Carrie. "I got something."
"Well, I did," he said, angered almost to harsh words. "You needn't throw up your success to me. All I asked was a little help until I could get something. I'm not down yet. I'll come up all right."
He tried to speak steadily, but his voice trembled a little. Carrie's anger melted on the instant. She felt ashamed. "Well," she said, "here's the money," and emptied it out on the table. "I haven't got quite enough to pay it all. If they can wait until Saturday, though, I'll have some more."
"You keep it," said Hurstwood sadly. "I only want enough to pay the grocer."
She put it back and proceeded to get dinner early and in good time. Her little bravado made her feel as if she ought to make amends. In a little while, their old thoughts returned to both. "She's making more than she says," thought Hurstwood. "She says she's making 12, but that wouldn't buy all those things. I don't care. Let her keep her money. I'll get something again one of these days. Then she can go to the deuce." He only said this in his anger, but it prefigured a possible course of action and attitude well enough. "I don't care," thought Carrie. "He ought to be told to get out and do something. It isn't right that I should support him." In these days, Carrie was introduced to several youths, friends of Miss Osborne, who were of the kind most aptly described as gay and festive. They called once to get Miss Osborne for an afternoon drive. Carrie was with her at the time.
"Come and go along," said Lola.
"No, I can't," said Carrie.
"Oh, yes, come and go. What have you got to do?"
"I have to be home by 5, said Carrie.
"What for?"
"Oh, dinner."
"They'll take us to dinner," said Lola.
"Oh, no," said Carrie. "I won't go. I can't."
"Oh, do come. They're awful nice boys. We'll get you back in time. We're only going for a drive in Central Park."
Carrie thought a while, and at last yielded. "Now I must be back by 4:30, she said. The information went in one ear of Lola and out the other. After Drouet and Hurstwood, there was the least touch of cynicism in her attitude toward young men, especially of the gay and frivolous sort. She felt a little older than they. Some of their pretty compliments seemed silly. Still, she was young in heart and body, and youth appealed to her.
"Oh, we'll be right back, Miss Medenda," said one of the chaps, bowing. "You wouldn't think we'd keep you over time, now, would you?"
Well, I don't know, said Carrie, smiling.
They were off for a drive, she looking about and noticing fine clothing, the young men voicing those silly pleasantries and weak quips which pass for humor in coy circles. Carrie saw the great park parade of carriages beginning at the 59th Street entrance and winding past the Museum of Art to the exit at 110th Street and 7th Avenue. Her eye was once more taken by the show of wealth, the elaborate costumes, elegant harnesses, spirited horses, and above all, the beauty. Once more the plague of poverty galled her, but now she forgot in a measure her own troubles so far as to forget Hurstwood. He waited until 4, 5, and even 6. It was getting dark when he got up out of his chair.
I guess she isn't coming home, he said grimly. That's the way, he thought. She's getting a start now. I'm out of it.
Carrie had really discovered her neglect, but only at 4:15, and the open carriage was now far up 7th Avenue, near the Harlem River.
What time is it? She inquired. I must be getting back.
4:15, said her companion, consulting an elegant, open-faced watch.
Oh, dear me, exclaimed Carrie.
Then she settled back with a sigh.
There's no use crying over spilled milk, she said. It's too late.
Of course it is, said the youth, who saw visions of a fine dinner now, and such invigorating talk as would result in a reunion after the show. He was greatly taken with Carrie.
We'll drive down to Delmonico's now and have something there, won't we, Oren?
To be sure, replied Oren gaily.
Carrie thought of Hurstwood. Never before had she neglected dinner without an excuse. They drove back and at 6:15 sat down to dine. It was the sherry incident over again, the remembrance of which came painfully back to Carrie. She remembered Mrs. Vance, who had never called again after Hurstwood's reception, and Ames. At this figure her mind halted. It was a strong, clean vision. He liked better books than she read, better people than she associated with. His ideals burned in her heart.
It's fine to be a good actress, came distinctly back.
What sort of an actress was she?
What are you thinking about, Miss Medenda? Inquired her merry companion.
Come now, let's see if I can guess.
Oh, no, said Carrie, don't try. She shook it off and ate. She forgot, in part, and was merry. When it came to the after-theater proposition, however, she shook her head.
No, she said, I can't. I have a previous engagement.
Oh, now, Miss Medenda, pleaded the youth.
No, said Carrie, I can't. You've been so kind, but you'll have to excuse me.
The youth looked exceedingly crestfallen.
Cheer up, old man, whispered his companion. We'll go around anyhow. She may change her mind.
40. A public dissension. A final appeal. There was no after-theater lark, however, so far as Carrie was concerned. She made her way homeward, thinking about her absence. Hurstwood was asleep, but roused up to look as she passed through to her own bed.
Is that you? He said.
Yes, she answered. The next morning at breakfast, she felt like apologizing. I couldn't get home last evening, she said.
Ah, Carrie, he answered. What's the use saying that? I don't care. You needn't tell me that, though.
I couldn't, said Carrie, her color rising. Then, seeing that he looked as if he said, I know, she exclaimed,
Oh, all right, I don't care.
From now on, her indifference to the flat was even greater. There seemed no common ground on which they could talk to one another. She let herself be asked for expenses. It became so with him that he hated to do it. He preferred standing off the butcher and baker. He ran up a grocery bill of $16 with Erslager,
laying in a supply of staple articles so that they would not have to buy any of those things for some time to come. Then he changed his grocery. It was the same with the butcher and several others. Carrie never heard anything of this directly from him. He asked for such as he could expect, drifting farther and farther into a situation which could have but one ending. In this fashion, September went by.
"Isn't Mr. Drake going to open his hotel?" Carrie asked several times.
"Yes. He won't do it before October, though, now." Carrie became disgusted. "Such a man," she said to herself frequently. More and more she visited. She put most of her spare money in clothes, which, after all, was not an astonishing amount. At last the opera she was with announced its departure within 4 weeks. "Last 2 weeks of the great comic opera success, the blank, etc., was upon all billboards and in the newspapers before she acted."
"I'm not going out on the road," said Miss Osborne.
Carrie went with her to apply to another manager. "Ever had any experience?" was one of his questions.
"I'm with the company at the casino now."
"Oh, you are," he said.
The end of this was another engagement at 20 per week.
Carrie was delighted. She began to feel that she had a place in the world. People recognized ability. So changed was her state that the home atmosphere became intolerable. It was all poverty and trouble there, or seemed to be, because it was a load to bear. It became a place to keep away from. Still, she slept there and did a fair amount of work, keeping it in order. It was a sitting place for Hurstwood. He sat and rocked and read, enveloped in the gloom of his own fate. October went by, and November. It was the dead of winter almost before he knew it, and there he sat. Carrie was doing better, that he knew. Her clothes were improved now, even fine. He saw her coming and going, sometimes picturing to himself her rise. Little eating had thinned him somewhat. He had no appetite. His clothes, too, were a poor man's clothes. Talk about getting something had become even too threadbare and ridiculous for him. So he folded his hands and waited for what he could not anticipate. At last, however, troubles became too thick. The hounding of creditors, the indifference of Carrie, the silence of the flat and presence of winter all joined to produce a climax. It was affected by the arrival of Urslaga personally when Carrie was there.
"I call about my bill," said Mr. Urslaga.
Carrie was only faintly surprised.
"How much is it?" she asked.
$16, he replied.
"Oh, that much?" said Carrie.
"Is this right?" she asked, turning to Hurstwood.
"Yes," he said.
"Well, I never heard anything about it."
She looked as if she thought he had been contracting some needless expense.
"Well, we had it all right," he answered.
Then he went to the door.
"I can't pay you anything on that today," he said mildly.
"Well,
when can you?" said the grocer.
"Not before Saturday, anyhow," said Hurstwood.
"Huh," returned the grocer.
"This is fine. I must have that. I need the money."
Carrie was standing farther back in the room, hearing it all. She was greatly distressed. It was so bad and commonplace. Hurstwood was annoyed also.
"Well," he said, "there's no use talking about it now. If you'll come in Saturday, I'll pay you something on it."
The grocery man went away.
"How are we going to pay it?" asked Carrie, astonished by the bill. "I can't do it."
"Well, you don't have to," he said. "He can't get what he can't get. He'll have to wait."
"I don't see how we ran up such a bill as that," said Carrie.
"Well, we ate it," said Hurstwood.
"It's funny," she replied, still doubting.
"What's the use of your standing there and talking like that now?" he asked. "Do you think I had it alone? You talk as if I'd taken something."
Well, it's too much, anyhow, said Carrie. I oughtn't to be made to pay for it. I've got more than I can pay for now.
All right, replied Hurstwood, sitting down in silence. He was sick of the grind of this thing. Carrie went out, and there he sat, determining to do something. There had been appearing in the papers about this time rumors and notices of an approaching strike on the trolley lines in Brooklyn. There was general dissatisfaction as to the hours of labor required and the wages paid. As usual, and for some inexplicable reason, the men chose the winter for the forcing of the hand of their employers and the settlement of their difficulties. Hurstwood had been reading of this thing and wondering concerning the huge tie-up which would follow. A day or two before this trouble with Carrie it came. On a cold afternoon, when everything was gray and it threatened to snow, the papers announced that the men had been called out on all the lines. Being so utterly idle and his mind filled with innumerous predictions which had been made concerning the scarcity of labor this winter and the panicky state of the financial market, Hurstwood read this with interest. He noted the claims of the striking motormen and conductors, who said that they had been wont to receive $2 a day in times past, but that for a year or more trippers had been introduced, which cut down their chance of livelihood one half and increased their hours of servitude from 10 to 12 and even 14. These trippers were men put out during the busy and rush hours to take a car out for one trip. The compensation paid for such a trip was only 25 cents. When the rush or busy hours were over, they were laid off. Worst of all, no man might know when he was going to get a car. He must come to the barns in the morning and wait around in fair and foul weather until such time as he was needed. Two trips were an average reward for so much waiting, a little over 3 hours' work for 50 cents. The work of waiting was not counted. The men complained that this system was extending, and that the time was not far off when but a few out of 7,000 employees would have regular $2-a-day work at all. They demanded that the system be abolished, and that 10 hours be considered a day's work, barring unavoidable delays, with $2.25 pay. They demanded immediate acceptance of these terms, which the various trolley companies refused. Hurstwood at first sympathized with the demands of these men. Indeed, it is a question whether he did not always sympathize with them to the end, belie him as his actions might. Reading nearly all the news, he was attracted first by the scareheads with which the trouble was noted in the World. He read it fully, the names of the 7 companies involved, the number of men. "They're foolish to strike in this sort of weather," he thought to himself. "Let them win if they can, though." The next day, there was even a larger notice of it. "Brooklynites walk," said the World. "Knights of labor tie up the trolley lines across the bridge. About 7,000 men out." Hurstwood read this, formulating to himself his own idea of what would be the outcome. He was a great believer in the strength of corporations. "They can't win," he said concerning the men. "They haven't any money. The police will protect the companies. They've got to. The public has to have its cars." He didn't sympathize with the corporations, but strength was with them. So was property and public utility. "Those fellows can't win," he thought. Among other things, he noticed a circular issued by one of the companies which read, "Atlantic Avenue Railroad. Special notice. The motormen and conductors and other employees of this company have abruptly left its service. An opportunity is now given to all loyal men who have struck against their will to be reinstated, providing they will make their applications by 12 o'clock noon on Wednesday, January 16th. Such men will be given employment, with guaranteed protection, in the order in which such applications are received, and runs and positions assigned them accordingly. Otherwise, they will be considered discharged, and every vacancy will be filled by a new man as soon as his services can be secured. Signed, Benjamin Norton, President." He also noted among the want ads one which read, "Wanted, 50 skilled motormen, accustomed to Westinghouse system, to run U.S. mail cars only in the city of Brooklyn. Protection guaranteed. He noted particularly in each the protection guaranteed. It signified to him the unassailable power of the companies. They've got the militia on their side, he thought. There isn't anything those men can do. While this was still in his mind, the incident with Erslaga and Kerry occurred. There had been a good deal to irritate him, but this seemed much the worst. Never before had she accused him of stealing, or very near that. She doubted the naturalness of so large a bill. And he had worked so hard to make expenses seem light. He had been doing butcher and baker in order not to call on her. He had eaten very little, almost nothing. "Damn it all," he said. "I can get something. I'm not down yet." He thought that he really must do something now. It was too cheap to sit around after such an insinuation as this. Why, after a little, he would be standing anything. He got up and looked out the window into the chilly street. It came gradually into his head, as he stood there, to go to Brooklyn. "Why not?" his mind said. "Anyone can get work over there. You'll get two a day." "How about accidents?" said a voice. "You might get hurt." "Oh, there won't be much of that," he answered. "They've called out the police. Anyone who wants to run a car will be protected, all right." "You don't know how to run a car," rejoined the voice. "I won't apply as a motorman," he answered. "I can ring up fares, all right." "They'll want motormen, mostly." "They'll take anybody, that I know." For several hours he argued pro and con with this mental counselor, feeling no need to act at once in a matter so sure of profit.